This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 68 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. So I was on Twitter yesterday and I saw a RotoWorld tweet that said, "Gruden, we will play the hot hand at receiver." You've got to be freaking kidding me. This hot hand nonsense has to stop. I understand the notion behind it and how they're playing the player who's been performing best within the game set of circumstances. I get it. But it's also really dumb. Just play your best players. A one-quarter sample size of Josh Doctson playing football against the Cowboys is surely not going to tell you whether he's a hot hand over Terrell Pryor, especially if Josh Doctson is on the field over Pryor during the early parts of the game, so you don't even know if Terrell Pryor is going to have the hot hand. The phrase hot hand is stupid too. Imagine using that in your everyday life. A waiter says, "Would you like french fries or potato chips with that?" Whichever one has the hot hand, man. Whichever one has the hot hand. Like, why can't coaches just make sound, logical decisions? Why can't Jay Gruden see what Terrell Pryor has done so far this season, realize that maybe he's not a fit for what they want to do, and just let Josh Doctson get some reps? How difficult is this? I've actually had people tell me on Twitter and IRL that my opinion is invalid because an NFL coach disagrees with it. Because an NFL coach is superior, and his opinion is far more intelligent than mine. I mean, it's true that coaches know more about football than I do. But that doesn't mean coaches are flawless. Coaches do dumb stuff literally every week. I mean, Bill O'Brien is considered a good coach, and he started his season with Tom Savage under center. Think about that for a second. He thought Tom Savage gave the Texans a better chance to win than Deshaun Watson. Anytime someone says that to you, remind them that you're not sitting on your couch or behind your computer coming up with hot hand takes. And because of that, we should all be able to criticize or question decisions made by coaches. Anyway, today's a mailbag show, which means I'll probably be getting even more heated than I am right now. Before we dig in, though, I just wanted to send a reminder that Jim Sonnis, Brandon Gadula, and yours truly from NumberFire.com are playing against FanDuel Friendsmo commissioners in the NumberFire Showdown this week and moving forward. To qualify, just be a FanDuel Friends Mode League commissioner and have your contest run for cash. That gets you into the $1,000 commish free play the next week. Finish in the top three in the free play, and you'll take on me, Brandon, and Jim the following week. If you win, you get $1,000 or more. But if one of us experts wins, we don't get anything, and FanDuel adds $500 to the next week's prize pool until a commish claims it. This week's prize pool is actually up to $1,500 because we, the experts, ended up winning last week. If you want to learn more about how you can play against me in this very special FanDuel contest, you can visit FanDuel.com/NumberFireShowdown. That's FanDuel.com/NumberFireShowdown. All right, let's dig into these questions. This first one is from Mike. "I'm in a 14-team league that hoards quarterbacks. Palmer was my only quarterback, so now I'm screwed. The only quarterbacks on the waiver wire are Trevor Siemian, Joe Flacco, CJ Beathard, Mitch Trubisky, and Cleveland's quarterbacks. I don't think I can use those guys to win a championship. I'm in first place with a 6-1 record, and I have the points lead. Six teams make the playoffs, so I'm almost a lock at this point to get in. It's a standard scoring league, and here's my roster." He then shows me his roster, which looks pretty good on paper. "I can trade Michael Thomas for Russell Wilson. I'm an avid listener, so I know how you feel about the quarterback position in general, and especially trading for one. But you also look at things as being situationally dependent. I feel like this is one of those times where it's better to trade and get a top five quarterback rather than depend on a bottom guy every week from here on out, since I have a realistic shot at the championship. I'm not loaded at wide receiver, but Michael Thomas hasn't been carrying my team either. And when Stephon Diggs comes back, I'll be okay. Any thoughts are greatly appreciated." You're right, Mike. I try to avoid sweeping statements because every situation is indeed different. But in a single quarterback league, one thing is consistent. Quarterbacks are not valuable, even if there aren't a ton of quarterbacks on the waiver wire. Giving up Michael Thomas right now would be giving up a very valuable asset for a not so valuable asset. Just because you're in first and looking good doesn't mean you should make a bad trade. Like, imagine if the Chiefs lost Kareem Hunt to an injury and he was sidelined for the year. Please, I hope to God that does not happen. Could you imagine if the Chiefs went to, like, I don't know, the Falcons, and they said, we'll give you Tyreek Hill for Tevin Coleman, just because Tevin Coleman would fill their need at running back? Of course not. We know running back isn't a highly valuable position in real football, so you wouldn't want to surrender a valuable piece like Tyreek Hill for that player. That wouldn't make any sense. Could the Chiefs trade some other assets to the Falcons to get Tevin Coleman? Sure. Just like you can send other assets for Russell Wilson. Or, to be honest, and this is what I would do in this situation, I would send bench assets for bench quarterbacks. If everyone has two or three quarterbacks rostered in your league, that means they have plenty of them rotting on their bench. Take advantage of that, snag a couple of them in smaller trades, and then platoon the quarterback position and play by matchup moving forward. That's how I would handle this situation. This next one's from Twitter, at Eric Renner. I dislike the industry standard weekly ranking system. It doesn't account for floor and ceiling. Am I overthinking this? Is there a better way? No, you're not overthinking this at all. I mention this all the time on this podcast, especially on shows that I did over the offseason. In fact, instead of talking about this answer here and reiterating things, if you go to episode 12 on building projections where I talked to ESPN.com's Mike Clay, I have an entire intro dedicated to why rankings are overvalued and stupid in fantasy football. I even talked about Terrell Pryor in that intro, which is kind of funny when looking back at things. I talked about how I could envision a season where Terrell Pryor was a top 10 or top 15 wide receiver, but I also recognize that he also has an insanely low floor. And we're seeing that awful low floor now. That's why you couldn't confidently rank Terrell Pryor that high entering the season. Because he had a low floor, and that was all part of his range of outcomes. But check that out. It's episode 12, and it'll give you a much better answer than what I'm providing right now. This next one is from Brian. He says, hey JJ, I'm having a strategy debate with someone that feels like the perfect topic for your type of analysis. A lot of leagues give a wildcard playoff spot to a team with the highest points for, regardless of record. If you're out of the running by record, does your strategy change? I made the argument that playing higher ceiling, higher variance players makes more sense. You need to take more risk because success requires a higher reward and high floor players are therefore less valuable. The counter argument is that higher variance is more likely to balance out or produce failure, so the overall strategy shouldn't change. Thoughts? I think you're overthinking it, and this is coming from a fantasy player who likes to look at each individual player's risk profile each week. That's an important piece to team building. But here's the thing, you obviously want to just have an optimal lineup each week in fantasy football. So really, you're talking about maybe one or two plays each week where you're deciding between a floor player and a ceiling player, a Danny Amendola or a Ted Ginn. I think where your thinking may be a little flawed is when you say that you need the higher variance to capture that upside since success requires a higher reward. I don't know if that's true. Like, let's just say that the sixth spot in your league goes to the most points scored who's not in the playoffs yet via record. That's how I run a lot of my leagues. In that case, the top five teams, hypothetically, are already in the playoffs. The teams that have scored the most points are already in. So you're not competing against top-notch teams to get into the playoffs. You just need to be better than the bottom half of your league. And we know that plenty of teams are going to suck. Plenty of those teams are out of the running for most points not in the playoffs. So maybe you're competing with just three or four teams. When you think of it that way, then only playing high-variance players just for the sake of playing high-variance players doesn't make a lot of sense. But not only that, I just think that you're overthinking this to begin with. If you play only higher-variance players, you probably would just even out by season's end. Sometimes they hit, sometimes they don't hit. And I think you're overstating how frequent those decisions actually happen each week on your roster. I like the thought process and that you or maybe someone else are thinking this way, but just do your best to be smart and play optimally. This next one is an email. It says, hi JJ, I have Greg Zuerlein on bye this week and my bench guys to drop are James Conner, Deontay Foreman, and Juju Smith-Schuster. It's a standard league and currently Greg the Leg is outscoring Antonio Brown for the season. Should I drop one of those stashes or risk spending FOB getting Greg back next week? By the way, I'm 6-1 and I know I'm talking about a kicker. I won't lie, this question put me on tilt. First off, we gotta stop this he's outscoring Antonio Brown stuff. That's irrelevant. If 15 kickers had more points than Antonio Brown, would that matter? Of course not. because that means everyone in your fantasy league has a kicker who has more points than Antonio Brown. Kicker is replaceable. Yes, Greg the Leg has the most fantasy points at the position, but he's also got a 7 field goal game buoying his totals. He's fine. He's been a great kicker in fantasy football, and the offense is scoring points and has seen positive game scripts. But I wouldn't be dropping high-end handcuffs or someone like Juju in order to keep Greg Zuerlein. Because on a week-by-week basis, you can still try to find players who will outscore Greg the Leg, especially when you consider that the Rams get the Vikings, Saints, Eagles, and Seahawks still over the back half of the season. Those are good teams that they're facing. And if they're facing those good teams, they might see negative game scripts, and if they're in negative game scripts, they might not kick many field goals. This next one is from Mike. Hey JJ, I love your work and the podcast for the in-depth analytical perspective and research to support your takes. I also wanted to thank you for directing me to the Dutch Destroyer video. It was very touching and made me a huge Carson Wentz fan. By the way, guys, if you have not watched that video that ESPN produced, it's unbelievable. I legitimately cried watching it. My question for you is, what do I do with Frank Gore? I know you were high on Marlon Mack, but I haven't heard your thoughts on Gore. He is my 7th running back. I can't seem to trade him. Is he droppable? Thanks again, Mike from Iowa. Yeah, you're not going to get much for Frank Gore right now. He's playing fewer snaps than Marlon Mack, and even when Mack was sidelined, Frank Gore was not very usable. Essentially, with cases like this, I try to just throw those types of players into potential trades just to see if it makes the other owner budge at all. You know, if you own Isaiah Crowell, for instance, just throw Isaiah Crowell into a trade. See if that tips the scales. Otherwise, yeah, with your running backs, though, with him being your 7th running back, you can probably just drop him. That's especially true given Andrew Luck's prognosis. This next question is a very, very important one. Morning, JJ. I wanted to write in and hopefully get some clarification on the topic of positive regression versus the gambler's fallacy. When I was in college, I took a probability and statistics course. In it, we learned about independent events and the probabilities surrounding them. For example, you're sitting around a roulette table at a casino and you watch 10 rounds go by where it hits red 10 times in a row. We know that a roulette table rolls out a red 50% of the time. Let's just leave out the green square for now. Does this mean that I should jump in and bet all my money on the black because it's due? From my understanding, positive regression tells me that yes, I should bet black because we expect the roulette table to positively regress back to a 50-50 split. But the idea of the gambler's fallacy, in my remembrance of my probability and statistics course, says it doesn't matter what you bet, because each round of roulette is independent of one another, and past outcomes do not affect future outcomes, i.e., the odds of the next roll hitting red is still 50-50. Replace the roulette table with Will Fuller and his touchdowns, and you could see how this idea might apply to fantasy football. Would love to hear your thoughts on this and some further explanation. Keep up the great work, Frank. Thanks for sending in this question, Frank, because it's really important that listeners of the show or readers of my work understand what I'm talking about when I talk about regression. Let's use Will Fuller as the example here since you mentioned him. Me saying that Will Fuller is going to regress in the touchdown column does not mean that we should expect Will Fuller to score 0 touchdowns from here on out in order to then, as an average throughout his season, have a touchdown rate that's more in line with his actual performance or his career averages. Regression does not mean overcorrection. That's basically what I'm saying. And that's what the gambler's fallacy is all about. Demaryius Thomas on the other end is another example. Over the last 2 years, Thomas has scored on every 17.72 receptions. This is just a very quick way of explaining this, so don't think that this is the only way that you should look at touchdown regression. It's just an example. But Demaryius Thomas has 30 receptions this year, meaning he should probably have between 1 to 2 touchdowns at the very least, given what he's done over the last 2 seasons. Now, that doesn't mean that I expect Demaryius Thomas's touchdown to reception rate to now be better during the second half of the season than what we've seen over the last couple of years. It just means that I expect it to be closer to the 1 per 17 receptions versus the 0 per 30 that he's seen so far in 2017. And the reason we bring up regression as analysts is because there are market inefficiencies. Fantasy owners don't always understand that touchdowns are more of a random statistic to compile than something like total yardage and receptions. If a player is seeing volume, or if those volume statistics are there, touchdowns should come. And when they're not coming, fantasy owners freak out. This guy just can't find the end zone. Well, it's not usually that simple. Sometimes players fall down on the 1 yard line a lot. Sometimes they're seeing volume but just can't convert due to variance. Or sometimes they face tough matchups. So to answer your question, you're exactly correct with what the gambler's fallacy is all about. And when I talk regression, I'm not saying a player will completely blow up to make up for what he hasn't done so far. I say it meaning his play should improve to what the average is, because that's what regression means. This next question is from Twitter, and it ties into what I was just talking about, so I figured that it would be beneficial to have it next. The dude on Twitter who asked this had been talking to me about the charts that I tweet out each week that show running back attempts and rushing yards versus how many touchdowns that they should or shouldn't have, along with the wide receiver chart that's basically the same thing. So at DennisKelly_real says, someone else might have more touchdowns than they should, and you say regression's coming, but when would you begin to accept they could be an exception? So just to give you a little more background, the charts that I tweet each week aren't there to say, this is definitely going to happen. I'm just looking at things like receiving yardage for wide receivers and showing basically how many touchdowns a wide receiver has scored over the last 6 years, given that number of receiving yards. Let's pretend a wide receiver has scored a touchdown for every 150 receiving yards over the last 6 seasons. If a player this year has 450 receiving yards, but just 2 touchdowns, then that means that the receiver should actually have 3 based on regression analysis, based on what's happened over the last 6 years. Or we should expect that player to be a little bit better at scoring from here on out. That's what those charts are showing. But they're also there to help us see things at a high level, and then they should be forcing us or making us dig deeper into certain situations. For instance, Green Bay wide receivers generally always have high touchdown rates. Is it because they're really good? I mean, sure. Yeah, they're good. But they also have Aaron Rodgers. That accounts for a lot. And some players don't see a lot of targets close to the end zone. That matters too. And then there are some freak athletes who are amazing in the red zone. Dez Bryant scores a lot of touchdowns because he's good at that area of the field. He's good at football. He's a great touchdown scorer. The point here is that when we're looking at that high level, when we're looking with a bird's eye view, it's important to not just make assumptions. The goal of those charts is to analyze further. Like, take Adam Thielen. He's got so much going for him. He's seeing deep balls, he's got a lot of air yards, he's got a high target market share, but he hasn't scored a touchdown. He's one player who we should probably expect some sort of turnaround because it's becoming statistically insane that he hasn't scored a touchdown. Even if that touchdown is a long touchdown, a touchdown that has a lot of variance embedded in it. It's still crazy that Adam Thielen has not scored this year. On the opposite end is Will Fuller. Some people have said to me, what if Will Fuller is just really good at catching touchdowns? And I'll respond with, that's totally fine. And that might be the case very easily. Will Fuller might be good at scoring touchdowns. But what he's doing right now isn't just being good at scoring touchdowns. What he's doing right now is completely unsustainable even for a touchdown scorer. Even if he's the best touchdown scorer in the world, he cannot keep this up. It's not how math works. And I should also kind of note here that we often live in the moment with this kind of stuff. What separates good fantasy players from bad ones is that they don't overreact to small samples, and they're able to see that greater picture. Tariq Cohen comes to mind. He's explosive. He's fun to watch. He's a good receiver. But fantasy owners let the shiny new toy aspect of things overshadow what was really happening to start the year. To assume the Bears could sustain a passing attack that went through a small rookie running back doesn't make any sense. And he's not even the lead back on his own team. This isn't just hindsight BS either. I talked about this everywhere, on Twitter, in my columns. It's just how football works. And for the record, outliers do exist. Like if Will Fuller keeps up his touchdown rate, which he won't, but let's pretend that he does, I don't really beat myself up for saying that he was a sell candidate. Because he was. 99 times out of 100, you will get that right. What annoys me most is when I'm wrong, because that happens a lot, when I should have been right. It's when I get something wrong while missing something obvious or smart about a player. And that happens all the time. Like I said, I get stuff wrong all the time because of that. I can't account for everything. It's impossible to do that, but I do my best to try to do that. But to tie back to the question, regression analysis is a really good place to start and see if players are just generally over or underperforming. That's what those charts are all about. And then from there, you should dig into their specific situations. Or let me do it, and I'll tell you what's up. That's the last question, though, for this week's mailbag. Thanks again for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to this show, do so by going to iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. Don't forget to leave a rating and review on iTunes, too. I'll be drawing a reviewer's name at random next week to see who wins a free NumberFire premium subscription for an entire year, so go get on that. While we're at it, also don't forget to follow me on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. I sometimes send good tweets. Thanks, everyone. As always, I'm humbled by the fact that you take time out of your day to listen to me, even if it's happening in your car or on a train during your commute. It means a heck of a lot. Enjoy your weekend.